life journey and all the moments and all the decisions and just how you got to where you are. I mean, I think it's amazing that this group of people has been gathered in this place for this moment, knowing that each and every one of you has a story, has a distinct narrative that you are living. And it's different from everyone else. Even if you're brother and sister and you're sitting next to each other and you've grown up together in this whole area, your stories are completely different, even though they share some similar elements. But have you ever found yourself, as you think about your life and you think specifically about the great things, but also think about the pain and the suffering, have you ever found yourself comparing it to someone else's and wondering why God allowed you to go through the things He's allowed you to go through when this other person seems to have a free ride? Like, man, everything they do turns to gold. Everything they touch works. Everything they've ever done, they've got more, better raw materials to work with. They're smarter, they're more athletic, they're better looking. And maybe you've grown up with this person and you're like, wow, I just cannot stand that person. God, why? Why have they gotten the easy road and I've had this winding, twisty, turny, dangerous road? Or maybe it's worse than that. Maybe for you, you look at your life and you think, boy, I've always tried to do the right thing no matter what. I've always tried to be real and authentic. And yet this other person has shown everyone around them this sort of false picture of who I know them to be. And yet they keep getting away with it, and they get away with it, and I know who they really are. And you desire for that person to be dragged into the light for who they really are. We've been walking through a journey this summer, and this is the final week, the final disciple today. His name is Peter. Peter, the rock. I'm just going to give you a brief biographical overview of Peter, and then we're going to focus on one particular event that's sort of the culmination of a lot of other events in Peter's life. So quickly, from an overview perspective, we know his name was Simon, son of John. His brother's name is Andrew. If you remember when we talked about Andrew, as soon as Andrew and the disciple John started following Jesus, Andrew runs home and grabs his brother Simon and brings him to Jesus, and Jesus looks at him and says, huh, your name is Simon. Now your name is Peter, the rock. Just immediately renames him in that moment. I don't know if any of you had that experience your first day with a new teacher. I don't think that happens very often anymore. Maybe a nickname emerged. But Jesus looked at him and literally changed his identity. Like God did from Abram to Abraham, like would later happen from Saul to Paul, Jesus changes Peter's name. He was the chief student of the rabbi that he was following, Jesus Christ. Jesus functioned in that culture as Lord, as teacher, as rabbi, and Peter was seen, you know, all scholars agree that Peter would have been the spokesman of the group. You see him often speaking for the group, on behalf of the group, leading, being the first one out of the gates to do something, to try something. It didn't always work out well for Peter, but at least he was willing to follow Jesus no matter what. The name for this position of chief student was Talmid Hakam, which meant the chief student of the rabbi, so the leading student. Typically, it was the oldest one. We know Peter was the oldest disciple. We have scriptural evidence he was the only disciple that was married at the time that he followed Jesus because he had a mother-in-law. And so that means that he was a married man. We talked last week about the youth of John when he followed Jesus and how we knew from that passage in Matthew about the temple tax that Jesus said to Peter, go and pay yours and my temple tax. And the temple tax was only owed by men, Jewish men over the age of 20. No other disciples were required to pay that in that passage, in that context. They were all standing there. But Jesus only asked Peter to pay. Therefore, the other disciples were under the age of 20, which fits not only that passage, but also the cultural understanding of discipleship at that time, that they would have been teenagers. I know for some of you that are hearing that for the first time, it's messing with your mental images of the disciples with long gray beards and some of them even limping at some point because they were so old to follow Jesus. But culturally, they would have been younger to be in discipleship with a rabbi. You think of some moments here when Jesus called Peter and said, come follow me. He was fishing. He was a fisherman. Remember what Jesus said to him? Come follow me and I will make you fishers of men. Citing an Old Testament passage in that moment. If you remember the time where Jesus appeared to the disciples on the Sea of Galilee and he's walking on water, and Peter says, Lord, tell me to come to you. And he calls to him, and Peter steps out of the boat onto the water, and he starts to walk, and it's very exciting. And then he starts to doubt. He looks at the wind, or he looks at the waves and the water, and he starts to doubt, and then he sinks and goes down. Now, what's amazing about that passage is not so much the bold faith of Peter, which is what we focus on a lot, that Peter was willing to get out of the boat and follow Jesus. What we should also think about is, why didn't any of the others do it? Because Peter was doing what a disciple would do. If your rabbi's walking on the water, then you should be able to do whatever your rabbi does. And if he calls to you, then they should have all gotten out. So Peter was the only one willing to risk and follow Jesus in that moment. If you look at his stories about moments with Peter, if you remember at Caesarea Philippi, where Jesus says, who do you say that I am? And Peter stands up and says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Saying Christ, that meant Messiah. You are Christ, you are the promised one, and you are God. You are the Son of the living God. One of the strongest statements of Jesus' divinity in the entire New Testament made by Peter in this moment. But immediately after that, as true to Peter, Peter gets upset because Jesus says he's going to die. He's going to have to die and then be raised from the grave. And Peter says, no, Lord, I don't want this to happen to you. Don't let this. And Jesus says to him, get behind me, Satan, for you have not a mind on the things of heaven, but the things of earth. So in the moment that Peter declares Jesus to be Messiah and God, he also functions as the devil. So it's just sort of a perfect picture of Jesus' life, or of Peter's life. The high points and the low points tended to come together very quickly and very loudly and very publicly. We also see from different episodes that Peter was the chief student of Jesus, but also he tended to elevate himself. You guys remember the week that we talked about Thomas, doubting Thomas, and how we made the comparison between Thomas typically saying, we should follow, we should do this, talking on behalf of the disciples, whereas Peter would say things like, I want to follow you, I will never desert you, I will die for you. Peter was a lot about himself and his leadership between he and God. He was an I type of a guy. All right, so that's just a brief biographical sketch of Simon Peter. And where we're going to sort of camp out, we're going to camp out at the end of the book of John, but we're going to start in John chapter 13. So if you want to turn over to John chapter 13, we're going to look at just a couple verses that sort of set up where we're going to be today. John chapter 13. If you remember this particular passage from John 13 to John 17, it's called the Upper Room Discourse. And this is it starts in John 13 with Jesus washing his disciples' feet. And then in John 14, he talks about being the way, the truth, and the life, and that he's going, and then they can't follow him. John 15, he talks about being the vine and the branches. John 16, he promises the Holy Spirit's going to come when he leaves. And he warns the disciples in John 16 that they're going to face trouble and persecution in the world. And then John 17, he prays for himself, for his disciples, and then for his future church. So this whole discourse, and within there, he also institutes the Lord's Supper. So the best way to understand what happens in John 13 to 17 and the different parallel passages is that it's Jesus' final night on earth with his disciples that he spent years with, and he is downloading a lot of information into them. Because Jesus knows what's coming. He knows that he's about to leave them. He knows he's about to die. And so he is telling them a lot of stuff here, more than they can really understand or handle, which he even tells them. So it starts out in John chapter 13. And at the end of John chapter 13, listen to this exchange between Peter and Jesus. Simon Peter said to him, Lord, where are you going? Jesus answered him, where I am going, you cannot follow me now, but you will follow afterward. And Peter said to him, Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay down my life for you. Again, remember in the rabbi-disciple relationship, for a disciple to be told he can't follow his rabbi, this is horrible news. Why can't we go? We're only 3 years into this. And remember, for those that were following a rabbi with this proximity, that were part of his Talmudim, if they will, this was normally a 15-year journey. So we're only at year three. So Peter and the others are like, what are you talking about? We're not done. We've got so much more to learn. We're not ready yet. And so when Peter is told by Jesus, you can't follow me now, this is basically him saying, I'm ending this relationship. I'm ending this discipleship. And so Peter reacts like the rest of them, just scared. And what are you talking about? We're confused. We thought we were going to follow you. So Peter says, Lord, why can I not follow you? I will lay down my life for you. And Jesus answered in verse 38, will you lay down your life for me? Truly, truly, I say to you, the rooster will not crow till you have denied me three times. The rooster will not crow until you've denied me three times. So if you remember how this night plays out after this, Jesus leaves with the disciples. He goes to the Garden of Gethsemane up on the Mount of Olives, and he's up there praying, and the disciples keep falling asleep, and he keeps saying to them, why can't you stay awake? And you wonder if part of them is like, because this has been a very long night. There's been a lot of teaching, foot washing, crying. There's just a lot going on. But if you remember from the Judas story, that it's in this place, in this moment, that Judas comes with the soldiers, betrays Jesus. And if you remember what Peter does, what does Peter do when the soldiers try and take Jesus? He pulls out his sword, a Sicarii blade, and he cuts off the ear of the high priest's servant named Malchus. And Peter's thinking, there's a war on. There's something happening here. We got to step into this moment. We got to defend Jesus. We got to fight for him. And then Jesus rebukes him and picks up the ear and puts it back on. But I mean, can you imagine the soldiers, though, in this moment? I feel like that movie, The Passion of the Christ, did probably a pretty good job of at least visually explaining where the guy's just kind of like sitting there, like tugging on his ear and holding his ear and like, you know, I don't know, looking at him. You almost just feel like Malchus was no good for the rest of that night and probably left that line of work and just walked around like, I know it's back on, but I swear it was off. You were there. It got cut off, right? That wasn't some bad dream I had. Like, and he put it back on, and yet we still killed this guy? Like, I'm so confused. But Peter's tendency was to act first and think later. So he pulls out the sword, cuts off the ear. And then what happens when Jesus tells them and rebukes them? They all run away and they all scatter. But Peter and John, the text tell us, follow this group of soldiers from a distance. And they actually get into the high priest's courtyard where Jesus' mockery of a trial is taking place. And you've got Peter outside with John, and people are gathering around and wondering what's going on. And a servant girl recognizes Peter as being the chief student of Jesus and says, wait a second, I know who you are. You're one of his disciples, aren't you? He says, no, I don't know the man. And she says, no. Your accent is giving you away. That's Galilean. His disciples are from Galilee. I know it's you. No, I'm telling you, it's not me. The third time says, no, I know you are one of his. You are his disciple. And it says there that he calls down curses upon himself and says, I do not know the man. And in that moment, for the chief student of a rabbi to publicly denounce his rabbi or his association and say, I don't know him, I want nothing to do with him, this is unforgivable. And I know this is going to sound a little bit crazy, but Judas betrayed Jesus on this night. And it led to Jesus being led off and ultimately being crucified. But Peter's betrayal on this night was just as deep as Peter's. Peter betrayed Jesus just like Judas did. Judas, we don't have a story of Judas being forgiven and restored. Why? Judas runs back into the temple, tries to give the money back, says, I made a huge mistake. I betrayed innocent blood here. Take the 30 pieces of silver back. And the priests are like, no, we don't want that. That's blood money. And so they bought that potter's field, the field of blood with it, and said, this is on you. So think about it. He went to confess his sins in the temple to the priests for restoration, for forgiveness. And they said, you cannot be forgiven for this. We don't want any part of it, to Judas.
So what does Judas do next?
He hangs himself.
Judas thought he was beyond forgiveness. Now, as we see the gospel play out, we know the truth. Now, was Judas beyond the forgiveness of Jesus?
No.
No. The grace of Jesus Christ, no one is beyond it.
And so the two reactions that night, Judas killed himself.
But what did Peter do after he betrayed Jesus three times? It says that he wept bitterly, but then he goes back to his old job.
He goes back to fishing. Now, he had left that life for 3 years. Remember, Jesus said that, or it says in the text, he dropped everything and followed him.
So Peter goes back to his old life. So that's where we're going to pick up our actual story for this morning, John chapter 21.
John chapter 21, verse 1.
After this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias. And he revealed himself in this way: Simon Peter, Thomas, Nathanael, James and John, and two others of his disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, "I am going fishing." And they said to him, "We'll go with you." They went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. And Jesus said to them, "Children, do you have any fish?" They answered him, "No." He said to them, "Cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some." And so they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. Let me slow down here for a second. Peter wasn't a guy who went into the river with his fly fishing gear and his favorite fishing vest on, his favorite fishing hat, and he went out there on a spiritual retreat to just get some peace and catch some salmon. Or for many of you, that's what our fishing experiences are. It's just getting away from things, from life. It's the calm, it's the serenity, it's the joy of fishing, of pulling fish out of the water, and then sometimes throwing them back in the water. That wasn't Peter's relationship towards fishing. Peter was a professional fisherman. Now, this was not what's on ESPN 2 late at night or early Saturday mornings where they're doing contests. This was a guy who pulled fish out of the water for a living. He sold fish. So when Peter went back to fishing, this wasn't a men's retreat with a great activity. This was him saying, "I'm going back to my old job because I'm not worthy to follow Jesus anymore." This was his fallback plan. This was who he was before he met Jesus. And so he goes and he says, "Listen, I'm going fishing." And the other disciples, six others, hop on the boat with him. Some of them also professional fishermen, James and John for sure. And John MacArthur believes that this passage proves that there were seven fishermen, professional fishermen, in Jesus' group of disciples because they were all fishing with him. They go out at night because that's when you've caught tilapia in this area, is that you went out at night. So you've got up to seven professional fishermen on a boat. And it says clearly they were out there all night and they caught how much?
Nothing. They caught nothing.
So now here's Jesus standing on the shore. "Little children, have you caught anything?"
Don't you love it when someone asks you that?
You're coming up out of the water and you've got the empty pail and just the dejected look on your face. "How'd it go?" "I don't want to talk about it." "Did you get any deer this year?" "Please stop asking me that question.
I'm not a hunter yet, although several are trying to convert me right now. We'll see. I kind of feel like I missed my window by like 37 years or so. But we'll see. We'll see if it can come to me, even though I don't have the early childhood preparation.
But I know for some, like, there's just like this thing. It's like, "Man, don't tell me." Or the worst thing will be, "Oh, did you try to hunt in this area? Did you fish in this spot? Did you try this lure?" Now imagine being a professional fisherman and having someone say, "Hey, throw it on the other side of the boat." "Thanks, pal. Yeah, I'm sure that they're over here, but they're not over here." That's awesome. What a great idea. It'd be like someone coming to your job and be like, "Hey, how are your sales this month?" "They're terrible." "Well, have you ever tried being nicer?" Being nicer. Wow, what an amazing sales strategy. You should write books. You should be on the speaking circuit. Be nice and be a millionaire. Wow, thank you, Captain Obvious. That's awesome. Thank you so much for that incredible insight. So here are seven professional fishermen being told by somebody on the shore that they don't know is Jesus yet. Try the other side. So whether it be because they were too tired to fight or they were desperately wanting some sort of a fish to happen, they do it. They say, okay, fine. They put it over the other side. And so many fish hop into this net that they could barely haul it. Later in the text, it says there were 153 fish in the net. Now, there's lots of wild speculation about why that particular number was used. Most people land at a passage of Ezekiel that talks about the water that flows into the Dead Sea and how it comes to life. And it was believed in the ancient world there were 153 species of fish in total, and that that meant that the gospel was to all mankind. And no one really knows. That's just one theory. But anyway, so he tells them to throw the net over the side, and they do it. So they cast it. And now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. But think about what must be going through their minds at this point. They're no longer following Jesus actively. Peter goes back to his old job. And he must have thought, well, I can always go back to fishing because I'm a great fisherman. I can always do what I've always done because those skills are going to return immediately. I always have my fallback plan. If this God thing doesn't work out, I can always go back to here and it'll be fine. But isn't it great what Jesus allows to happen to Peter and the others? They couldn't fish. They came up empty. These are professionals. They did not strike out. And yet there were so many fish. This is what I love about this passage. Not only could they not catch any, but the fish were everywhere around them. They could probably even see them. Like the fish are almost like waving at them and then squirting away. Sometimes we assume that we are in control of our lives. Wrongly so. Sometimes we think that we can just go back. We can change course. God has changed you. God has done something powerful in your life. You've seen something and you know you can't go back. God has put a calling on your life. God has asked you to do something in the church. He's given you a gifting. He's given you a platform. He's given you an opportunity. And you do that and then something happens. And now you feel like you're no longer worthy. Now you feel like I can't do it anymore. No one can forgive me from this. I am too far from God. I cannot be restored. And so you go back to your old life, except that you found out that your old life isn't the way you left it. I remember before I got into ministry, I worked in several different companies and jobs as I went through high school and college and then post-college. And I think my success in the business world was always a point of pride for me. My father was a very successful businessman and had a long and very successful career. My mom also was a very good businesswoman, started her own business, and then worked as an interior designer for several years and did very well. So it was kind of in my blood a little bit. And so at a very young age, I would just ascend to these weird positions of influence. At the age of 19, I was director of public relations for a baseball card corporation, which is really odd, I know. But if you hear the whole scope of my life, it'll make more sense. But so I did that, and then at 22, I was director of sales and marketing for an internet company and did well there. And just any job I had, sales or otherwise, it just seemed to go very well. So in the back of my mind, I would always say things like, well, I'll be in ministry because I believe God has called me to it, but if I ever feel like it's not a good situation, or if I ever feel like it's not a great fit, I'll step back out of it because I can always go back to what I did before. I can always go back to business. I can always go back to sales. That world is always welcoming me with open arms. So I spent several years in Minnesota as pastor of student ministries, so grades 6 through 12, and did that for 4 years. And at the end of that time, I just kind of reached this point where I just had enough of student ministry work. No offense to any high schoolers, but I just had reached this point where that was sort of the end of my time. And out of respect for that age group, they know, they can tell when the youth pastor's phoning it in. They can just tell, because they are the most perceptive. and real, and they can cut through phonies in like 2 seconds. That's why so many parents are unsettled by their teenagers, because they can suddenly see right into their hearts. So Angie and I decided to take a step back, step out of ministry for a while, and I would just get a job in the real world until we figured out what our next step was. So we did. And then I found out that 5 years out of the business world does not translate well in interviews. So they're like looking at my resume like, well, okay, but what's this like 5-year gap here? What have you been doing for the last 5 years? I'm like, oh, I've been a pastor of student ministries. They're like, what? Why do you want this job? Are you going to go back to that? Like, immediately red flags were flying up in their heads. And what they were seeing on this resume did not seem to match the person that was sitting in front of them. Because God changes us, and then we go back to our old life, and we're not the same. And so I'm sitting in interviews, and I remember one time this guy was telling me what he did for a living and this job, and I was like, can I just ask you a question? He's like, sure. I was like, do you love what you do? And he was like, well, I make a lot of money, and I'm awesome, and you know, all this stuff. I'm like, well, no, no, no. I get that you're awesome and that you have a motorcycle and you're really cool, but like, do you love what you're doing? He got angry. He's like, what kind of question is that? You don't have the right to ask me that question. And I'm like, I think you answered it. He's like, well, we'll call you. I'm like, probably not, but we'll see you later. But I'm like, what am I doing? These are job interviews, and I'm like psychologically analyzing and counseling these men that I can tell are so unhappy in their jobs and their careers. When he describes the hours he has to work to maintain his lifestyle and how he has missed out on so much of his family, I'm just like, man, I'm different now. I can't go back to that. There's nothing wrong with it at all, but I tried to fit back into that world, and it wasn't a good fit. So finally, I found a job that was close. There was another better job, but it was too far of a drive, and I didn't want to drive an hour each way. So I took a job that was closer, and it was selling high-end home theater equipment, which I love that stuff, music, all that stuff, at a place called Stereo Land. You know, only now do I realize how cheesy that name is. At the time, I'm like, it's awesome. Why are you laughing? But as I was there, I realized it was hard. It was like I was just different. I didn't have the same teeth. I wasn't the shark in the water anymore. I was like the guppy or something. I don't know. Like, I had changed so much. And I was more interested in deepening relationships with people and getting to know them, the customers that I was selling these things to, and spending time with them and developing relationships with my coworkers. I started to realize that I could not go back. That God had shown me something and called me to something, and even though I felt like maybe I shouldn't be in it, or maybe I wasn't worthy of it, or that I can always go to my fallback plan, I realized that fallback plan should have been dealt with like Elisha dealt with his fallback plan. Remember what Elisha did when Elijah came and called him? He took the plow, the very symbol of his livelihood, and he broke it into pieces and he burned it as an offering to the Lord, saying, I am never going back. I am following God no matter what it takes, and I will never, ever go back. So here's Peter. He goes back and he cannot catch any fish because God is in control. God's not going to just allow him to go back to his old life. Every time the going gets tough, if Peter thought every time persecution comes, he can just run back and catch fish for a while and take a break and then return, can you imagine? Jesus needed to strip away everything else. Every other option needed to be off the table so that Peter would single-mindedly and focused on Jesus and not allow anything else to distract him. So look at verse 7. That disciple whom Jesus loved, we've established last week, that's John, the writer of this book, therefore said to Peter, it's the Lord. When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. Now it's pretty much believed that Peter would have been naked at this point, which may be another reason why the fish were so scared, and he wasn't able to catch any. I don't know if that's related at all, but so I think another thing that's interesting here is people don't normally put more clothing on before they jump into the water, right? Aren't we sort of in an attempt to get things off? You know, like if you get pushed in the water and you know your phone's in your pocket, you have that desperate, like, oh no, please, try and get it out as you fall in, or wallets or whatever else. Peter puts his cloak on. This was the outer garment. Why would he put his cloak on? Aside from the fact that he was not clothed at all, do you think that maybe Peter thought that he'd be able to walk on water again? Do you think that maybe he thought, it's back. Jesus is here. He's calling to me. He's out there. I'm going to put my cloak on and I'm going to walk the 100 yards back to shore. And I'm not going to doubt this time. And he jumps out of the boat and he sinks and gets completely soaked. Peter thinking he can go back to his fallback plan and fish. He doesn't catch any fish. Peter thinks, oh, I can go back to the old Peter, the rock, the one who walked on water. And he sinks. John is quick to explain that there were so many fish here, and John describes how they had to pull the boat in the rest of the way. Look at verse 8. The other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, about 100 yards off. I love how John puts this little thing in there like, yeah, as Peter was jumping out, the rest of us had to do all the work and get it into land. So verse 9, when they got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire in place, with fish laid down on it and bread. Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish that you have just caught. So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore, full of large fish, 153 of them. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. Now none of the disciples dared ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and so with the fish. This was now the third time that Jesus was revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. Now in verse 9 it says that there was a charcoal fire in place. It's interesting here because I feel like Jesus is setting the stage for Peter for his forgiveness, for his restoration, and for his healing. And we're going to see very soon that Jesus is going to recreate the scene in the high priest's courtyard where Peter denied Jesus three times. And it starts with this charcoal fire. The last time we saw this, the exact same wording being used was when they were warming their hands over a charcoal fire in the high priest's courtyard, drawing the mind already back to this other moment. Jesus was about to reopen Peter's deepest wound. Sometimes to get true healing, we need to pull off whatever short-term band-aid we have slapped on our wounds and allow Jesus to truly speak into that wound, reopen it and speak truth into it. Look at verse 15. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said to him, feed my lambs. Now you'll hear many different opinions about what this means. Do you love me more than these? And when Jesus says these, he's pointing to something, so it would have been something around them right there. Many people would say, do you love me more than these? Meaning it could have been Peter's family, his wife, and those around him. That's a possibility. Do you love me more than your family? It could have been pointing to the fishing gear that we know is a part of the story. Do you love me more than your livelihood, more than your fallback plan? But D.A. Carson and William Hendrickson, two great scholars that I respect, changed my thinking on this. They said what fits the context better and the verb usage here means, do you love me more than these? Pointing to the other six disciples. Saying, Peter, do you still think you love me more than they do? Remember what Peter said in John 13? I will follow you. I will die with you. And then what does he do? He denies him three times and runs. Jesus says, do you still think that you love me, Peter, more than these other disciples? Are you still better than them, Peter? Whew. Wow. Talk about going right into the wound. And when Jesus uses that word for love here, this is that word agape. This is that highest form of love. This is love sacrificial. This is love that is unconditional. This is love that is truly unto death. Peter, do you really believe that you unconditionally love me more than these other disciples, like you said before?
The I will follow. I will do this. I will do that. I will never fail. I will never leave you.
And Peter responds. He says, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. This word for know there, when he says, yes, Lord, you know, this is the other form of know. This is oida, which means the Greek word meaning a recollection of facts. This is recall. This is knowledge. This is just a mental understanding. Not the gnosko, which is that deep, intimate, relational, human knowledge, the intimacy knowledge. This is the other. This is him saying, you know the facts. You know that I love you. But something interesting happens here with the verb love here, with the word love here. He says, Jesus says, do you love me? Agape. But Peter says back to him, you know that I love you. And he uses the next form down. He says phileo. He says, you know that I love you like a brother, like a friend. You know that I really like you. Would be maybe the best way to translate that. You know that I don't love you enough. You know that I didn't love you without condition. You know all things. You remember what I did. You know I don't love you unconditionally. You know that when the conditions changed, I bailed. You know that I love you like a brother. And Jesus says to him, feed my lambs. Feed my lambs. Feed, care for, protect, and nurture lamb, this baby sheep that is so defenseless, so vulnerable, saying to him, care for these younger disciples. Take care of them. Care for the young ones in the faith. Will you feed them? Will you give them the teaching? Will you continue to lead them? This sort of idea of pastoring them, loving them and leading them and feeding them. Restating his leadership role among the disciples. You, Peter, are to lead them. Verse 16. He said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Again, agape. Do you agape love me? Do you unconditionally love me? Peter says to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. You oida, you have the recall, the remembrance, you know the facts, you know what happened, you know that I only love you like a brother. You know that. And Jesus says to him, tend my sheep. Tend my sheep. This would be the picture of saying, you need to shepherd, you need to protect, fight for, feed, control, lead, be the shepherd for this greater picture. Bigger than just the lambs, now it's a larger herd that we're talking about. Peter, be the leader, be the shepherd of my sheep, of the future church. Verse 17, Jesus said to him the third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was grieved because he said it to him a third time. Do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. This third time, Jesus changes the love word. This third time, Jesus says, Simon, do you love me like a brother? Do you really even like me? It says here, Peter was grieved because he said it for the third time. Do you think that right now Peter finally gets it? We know that when he denied Jesus three times, it says that he wept bitterly over that. And this was the deepest wound of his life. Here it says when he said it a third time, he was grieved, he was sad. It was like all of a sudden, it all makes sense. You're taking me back into this wounding. You're taking me back into this moment where I denied you once, twice, and three times. This is the third time you're asking me if I love you. And you're asking if I love you like a brother. And listen to what Peter does with the word know here. He says, Lord, you know oida. You know the facts. You know everything. You're omniscient. You know that I love you. The second no. Saying, Lord, you know everything. You know the facts, you know the stories, you remember, but you also know gnosko deeper that I really do love you. You know my pain, you know my hurt, you know me relationally, intimately, you know that all I'm capable of right now is loving you like a brother.
You know that when the conditions changed, I bailed. You know I'm not ready yet to commit to you and to sacrifice. You know where I am. You know my heart.
And Jesus said to him, feed my sheep.
This is a bigger call. This is saying now, not only are you going to tend them and to lead the flock and to shepherd them, now you're going to feed them, you're going to preach, you're going to teach, you're going to be in charge of all of this. You are going to be the primary one who teaches and preaches and feeds. This third time where he asks him that third time, and Peter finally gets it. It's the third time. And his wound reopens. Jesus speaks life into that wound of sin and shame. Jesus speaks forgiveness, restoration, love without condition into Peter's deepest wound. And remember, who's standing around while this is happening? Six other disciples. This is not being done in some quiet corner. This is Jesus purposefully doing this in front of the other disciples so that they would know Peter is being forgiven, healed, and restored to his leadership amongst the disciples and reaffirming his original calling and his role to be a major force in the movement of Jesus Christ. They are all witnesses to this. But it's amazing, isn't it, that the third time Jesus meets Peter where he is. He meets him at brotherly love. He understands that this is as much as Peter is capable of right now. And he affirms that. But he calls him to something much bigger, something he cannot see. Can you imagine at 3 a.m. when Peter is naked and fishing and catching nothing? Knowing that in just a couple hours he was going to be restored, his wound was going to be addressed, and it was going to be healed, and he was going to be forgiven by Jesus Christ, the very one that he so deeply offended and betrayed on the night he needed him the most. He restores him, and he places a huge calling on his life. And then Jesus goes further. Look at verse 18. Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. And there's a parenthetical added here by John. This he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. And after saying this, he said to him, follow me. So in this moment, Jesus tells him, Peter, you are going to die for me. Because when he talks about being led where you don't want to go, that's a reference to being incarcerated. And when it says you'll stretch your arms out, it's a reference to the early church. They believed very strongly that this meant that Peter was going to be crucified. And it turned out that he was crucified. That Peter and his wife were crucified together. And Peter was so committed to Jesus and to living for him and dying for him that he did not even feel he was worthy to die in the same way. And so he said, can you do it upside down? Crucify me upside down because I'm not worthy to die the same way that my Lord died. So Jesus predicts and tells Peter, just like he told him he was going to deny him 3 times and that came true, Peter here hears Jesus say, you are going to die for me. You're going to die a martyr's death. And listen to Peter's reaction. Verse 20. Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them. The one who had been reclining at a table close to him and had said, Lord, who is it that's going to betray you? So that's John reaffirming in that moment his intimacy with Jesus and just sort of his placement in the inner circle, sort of showing us that he would be walking with Peter and Jesus in this moment. Verse 21, when Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, Lord, what about this man? You see what's happening? Jesus just tells him, you're going to die, Peter. And what does Peter say? Well, what about him? What about John? He's inner circle. He walks with you. He wants to follow you. What's going to happen to him? Tell me what's happening to John. I want to know that I'm not the only one who's going to die this way. Is he going to die? Is he going to suffer? Is his fate the same as mine? This isn't fair. What's his future? Why do I have to suffer? I feel like this statement is so loaded with those sort of undertones. What about him? What about John? And what does Jesus say? Verse 22. Translation, none of your business, Peter. Jesus said to him, if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. Peter, it doesn't matter what I do with John. It doesn't matter what Andrew's future is. It doesn't matter what James is doing. It doesn't matter that 11 of these disciples are going to die martyrs' deaths. It does not matter. You follow me. Don't look left. Don't look right. Don't compare your story to theirs. Don't compare your pain to theirs. You follow me, Peter. What does it matter? Why do you care what happens to John? It has nothing to do with you. You set your course and you follow me. You pick up your cross and you follow me, Peter. Don't compare. I feel like in this moment, this is where so many of us find ourselves at times. This is where I find myself so often. When I look at what it took for me to be standing here in front of you today, I say, God, what in the world? Why do you have me on this path? Why so much suffering and pain? Why has my wife had to go through so much stuff? Why has she had to suffer like this, God? What about them? They didn't have any problems having kids right out of the gates. And what about them? They didn't have any problems with needing transplants. And what about that family? What about them? Why is he writing books? Why is he in a bigger church? All this stuff where I look around and I'm like, God, what in the world are you doing? And he just comes back and says, Peter, it's you and me. It is you and it is me. And I'm asking you to follow me. It doesn't matter what anyone else is doing. Cliff, you follow me. It doesn't matter what you think you're entitled to. It doesn't matter what other people are doing. It doesn't matter how you got here. All that matters is I'm saying to you, you follow me no matter what. You fix your eyes on me, the author and finisher of your faith, who for the joy set before you endured the cross and scorned the shame, is now seated at the right hand of God. You fix your eyes on me, Jesus says. Don't look to the left. Don't look to the right. Don't desire for this person to be dragged into the light and exposed for the hypocrite they are. Don't wait for you to go back to church until the day that all these people that are doing the wrong things get exposed. Or maybe your experience over here, you're like, I can't believe this life I led, this legalism I was under, it destroyed my life, it's destroyed my faith, and I'm not coming back until those people are all gone. It is between you and Jesus. You follow him. Don't look to the left. Don't look to the right. It's about your relationship with him. He died on the cross to save you and to have relationship with you. And everyone else has their stuff. Everyone else has their journey. The most selfish thing I can possibly think is that anyone else has it less than I have it. They have it easier than I have it. Because every single one of us is broken. Every one of us has hurt. Every one of us has pain. Every one of us has gone through something, whether it was how you were raised, or maybe it was the church you grew up in, or maybe it was a relationship that failed, or maybe it was physical pain and physical suffering, and you just find yourself looking around. God says, stop looking around and look at me. I have a plan for you. I love you. I'm not going to give you more than you can handle, although I know you doubt that at times. I have never, ever left you alone. I will never, ever abandon you. I will never, ever leave you. You follow me and let me take care of everyone else. And Peter did. In Acts chapter 1 and 2, you've got them sitting around the table. And the Holy Spirit comes like fire, and there's tongues, and they're speaking out ecstatic utterances to God in foreign languages that people around them could understand. And the people said, what are they, drunk?
What's going on over here? And it says that Peter stood up with the 11 and said, I love that moment. We're going to walk through the book of Acts at some point here. And I love to just park on that moment. Peter stood up. What did it mean for Peter to stand up? How much had happened in his life? How much had he been restored from, forgiven from, led through all of the events of Peter's life, led to that one moment where Jesus told him to stand? Peter stood up. He answered that ridiculous question and said, drunk, it's only 9 in the morning. And then he preached the message that changed human history. 3,000 people came to Jesus Christ that day. It said that they were cut to the heart and said, brothers, what must we do? And Peter says, repent and be baptized, every one of you. And 3,000 of them filled every fountain, every part of Jerusalem was being taken over with people getting dunked and people coming out of the water with a new and a changed life, leaving behind everything else. They're fixing their eyes on Jesus. They left their jobs. They left their families. They left their social circumstances and they fixed their eyes on Jesus at great cost as persecution was coming. Jesus' words to Peter, you follow me, are the same words to us today. You follow me. You follow Jesus. At some point, it's all about you and him, not about everyone else. The more we look around, the more we waste time. The more we look around, the more we invite more pain. The more we look around, the more we ask other people to affirm us and for us to please them, the wrong roads we start taking. The only one you need affirmation for in this world and from is from God himself. And he affirms you. He loves you. You're his child. He's created you this way. He's given you a plan and a purpose. It doesn't matter what anyone else thinks. You follow Jesus. That is the call. It's surrendering our life. It's laying it down. It's saying, God, I have plans. I have backup plans. I used to be a salesman. I've got my life figured out. And God says, no, drop everything and just follow me. Because following him like that takes trust. Because fear just rushes in, doesn't it? You ever felt God to ask you to trust him to do something and immediately fear just comes flying in? All the questions, all the accusations. Yeah, but what about this? And what about that? Have you thought about this? And what will they think? And what will your parents think? And what will they... And you're just like, oh, yeah, I'm not going to do it. Those are really good reasons. The Bible says that perfect love drives out fear. When you fix your eyes on Jesus and you trust him, fear has no place. The band's going to come up here right now and lead us in a song. It's a new song. It's a song called Stand, The Stand. And the idea is surrendering our hearts, surrendering our lives to God, and being willing, when the moment comes, to stand.